Chapter 12, Cave. Princess and her grandfather followed May to a small campfire in the northeastern quadrant of the castle grounds. May had filled their iron pot with water and was boiling the dried meat, vegetables, and herbs in it. The smell made Princess salivate and realize just how hungry she was. It had been a long day of hiking and excitement. She had been so distracted by exploring the castle grounds and listening to Orvin's story that she hadn't noticed her stomach growling. Everyone was hungry, and they ate quickly and in silence. Hugh, May, and Orvin seemed to be in a reflective mood. Perhaps they were remembering other meals eaten here in happier times. Princess looked around and tried to imagine the buildings and bustle of people working and playing around where she was sitting. She was unable to replace the overgrown ruins with her memories of the castle town, and it left her with a hollow, sad feeling. She was lost in these thoughts when her father interrupted them by saying, "Well, we should extinguish the fire and get down to the cave before it gets dark. It's a treacherous enough path in the daylight, and it's even more overgrown than the last time we were here."
"Wait, you've already been in the cave?" Princess asked.
"Sure," laughed Hugh. "Where do you think the water and aged firewood came from?"
"I don't know. I just..."
"You're right. There is no water up here since the well is gone.
You've got to show me," insisted Princess.
"All in good time, but first we have to clean up our mess," answered Hugh. "We need to be discreet, as always," he insisted. 10 minutes later, the fire was out, the ashes spread, and they were walking towards the southwestern corner of the castle grounds. Princess's fingers were tingling with excitement. She thought she remembered the cave, but wondered how her memories would match with reality. Hugh led the way down a steep, narrow path at the edge of the ravine. He warned everyone to be careful. The trail was heavily overgrown, covered in slippery rock fragments which shifted under their feet, and it was a long way down to the canyon floor. They squeezed between two pillars of rock and arrived at a small, 6-foot-wide, shallow opening tucked behind the rock face. It would be difficult to find for someone who didn't already know it was there. There were 30 or 40 stones in a pile on one side of the floor, and Princess could see a tall, thin crack along the back wall. Her dad explained that even though the cave entrance was naturally well hidden, they also filled the crack by stacking the stones in it when they left. Princess used to think her family's obsession with secrecy bordered on insanity. But that was before she saw what Kilwolf had done to Pride. She knew Kilwolf would do the same to them if they were discovered, and he had the chance. Her mom disappeared while she was listening to her father talk. Then her dad stepped into the crack and said, "Follow me." Princess followed him behind the boulder at the back of the alcove and discovered that the opening was more significant than it appeared. She carefully and nervously edged her way into the cave. Princess couldn't see anything in the pitch blackness and worried about the massive amount of rock, dirt, and even trees overhead, which seemed destined to collapse and crush her. She stopped and was about to turn back when she heard her mother's voice echoing ahead saying, "Just a little farther, sweetheart. It opens up and we have lots of candles lit." Princess closed her eyes and moved ahead purely by touch. Her eyes seemed to be taking forever to adjust from the brilliant late afternoon sunlight to the underground darkness, but she did start to see dull, muddy shapes when she reopened them. She could just barely see enough to make it 10 feet farther into the cave and around a corner to where her parents were sitting, surrounded by a dozen or more candles. They were in a low, broad chamber with a large pile of rocks at one end. She saw her parents standing there next to their packs and iron pot, watching her as if to see what would happen. It was absolutely still and silent underground, except for the sound of trickling water echoing in the distance. A few seconds later, Princess saw the huge moving shadows the flickering candlelight cast upon the walls, and her memories came rushing back. She raced towards the rock pile and looked near the wall on the left. The girl gasped when she saw her old straw bed was still there. She spun around and saw 40 more piles of straw clustered in small family groups. This had been her home for over a month. She remembered. It wasn't a dream or some wild tale told to children the night before a festival. She had really been here, and unlike the ruins above, it was mostly unchanged from the night they had fled. She started running from bed to bed, trying to remember who slept where. At first, it was fun reliving the memories of a 6-year-old who had viewed this as a big camping trip. But her joy diminished after she remembered name after name of people who did not survive past the first winter.
She also began to remember the names of friends who never even made it down to the cave. The little girl might have excitedly run around having a fun, secret campout for 40 days, but Princess now realized this was anything but a fun outing. This was a desperate attempt to survive. "I don't know how much you remember, Princess," her father was saying, "but this isn't a terribly girt cave. The Wells Basin is in a domed pit on the other side of this breakdown, and there are a few smaller rooms where we've stored the supplies. Come, walk with me." Princess followed her father as he scrambled over the rocky pile of breakdown at the end of the room. Her mother was busily arranging candles and fluffing some straw mattresses, and her grandfather was nowhere to be seen. The two of them climbed over, around, and under rocks for what seemed like hundreds of feet. Hugh kept warning her to watch her head. He said the danger wasn't with rocks falling down onto your head as much as it was your head rising up to strike low-hanging rocks. She tried to heed his warnings, but appreciated the wisdom of his words more than once as she stood up too quickly or didn't duck quite low enough. Finally, after 10 minutes or more of arduous scrambling, they stepped into a tall, narrow, almost circular chamber. The candlelight didn't come close to illuminating the high ceiling, but Princess could tell that this was the most towering and closed space she had ever seen. She saw the shimmering water in the raised pool in the center of the room and knew she was standing at the bottom of the well. "I still get chills when I remember the feeling of being lowered down into this abyss as a young boy," he said. "It was pitch black, and the only light I had with me was a small lantern. I had no idea how deep it went or what was at the bottom, because the illumination from my dim little lamp couldn't reach more than a few feet. The flame had to be enclosed so that it didn't burn the rope they were using to lower me, but that meant it didn't shed much light. They dropped more candles and tools shortly after I was on the ground and free, but I will always remember those first 10 minutes as one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. I rebuilt this retaining wall around the well's pool," he continued. "It took several days to get it right. First, I had to redirect the stream so I could work. Then I had to chisel the stones carefully so they fit tightly enough together to hold the water. And then I had to redirect the stream. I repeated this process 3 times before I successfully fashioned something that was sufficiently deep and watertight to fill the buckets. I don't know how long I was down here because there was no way to keep track of time, but it was at least several days, and that's why I started exploring the caves. I discovered several rooms, which we will look at next, and of course, the entrance. I just wish I had found the entrance the first day I was in here rather than the last." Orvin and May had entered the well room by this time, and Orvin said, "Well, let's show her and get out of this damp place. It's making my bones ache." Princess said, "I remember the room where the siege supplies are stored. It's back by the sleeping chamber." Orvin said, "Excellent memory, Princess. At the time, I remember how hard it was to get the sacks of grain and other dried foods through this girt pile of rocks. But now I'm grateful that it's all already over on the other side. There are, however, 2 more rooms that most people did not realize existed," he added. "Follow me. They aren't terribly easy to access, and we're going to get muddy, but they're worth the trip. I'm still amazed that your father found them. You must have been incredibly bored the first time you were down here, son." The old man walked over to the far side of the room and started climbing up the wall. He reached a ledge about 7 feet up and somehow pulled his torso onto it. It must have been a tight crawl space because, while his body disappeared to his waist, his legs remained thrashing and kicking into the empty air for several long seconds while he grunted and squirmed. When his feet finally disappeared, Hugh tapped Princess on her shoulder and said, "Your turn." Princess wasn't as tall or as strong as her grandfather, but she was so much lighter and more limber that she quickly climbed and shimmied her way onto the ledge and down the crawl space. She popped out into a low, winding hallway type of formation and saw her grandfather caked in mud and panting. She laughed at the sight of him and thought there was no way her mother was going to be joining them. A few minutes later, however, all 4 of them were sitting in the glowing candlelight, and she had a newfound respect for her mother. Orvin sighed and said, "The chambers are down here." Then he stooped and began shuffling down the low alley. 50 feet later, the passageway widened, and the ceiling rose to form a large room. Princess gasped when she saw it. 2 dozen people could have stood in it if it hadn't been filled with weapons and armor. Osser dumped everything of value down that well, not just the siege supplies, explained Orvin. You are looking at King Osred's armory. I'm sure the Killwolf and his army spent many of the 40 days they tramped around the castle ruins trying to figure out where all these weapons went, he laughed. Your father and I spent days dragging all this back here. Sometimes I wonder why we bothered, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. By the way, that is why there are no unburied bodies in the castle ruins. Killwolf's army was up there for over a month searching for Osred's treasure, and he certainly didn't want decaying bodies lying around. I imagine there is a mass grave somewhere around the area, but I've never had the time or the desire to search for it. But if King Osred dumped all his siege food and weapons into the well, did he also toss his gold in as well? Asked Princess. Ah, excellent question, Princess. I see you inherited my intellect as well as my beauty, joked Orvin. As long as she didn't inherit your attitude or sense of humor, muttered her mother. Princess secretly wished she had inherited her grandfather's sense of humor. He always seemed ready with a witty comment, unlike herself. Hugh and Orvin began moving a pile of shields which were stacked against the left wall. Princess saw an opening appear behind where they had been stacked, and after a few minutes the two men stepped back and swept their arms towards it. Ladies first, said Hugh with an extravagant bow. Princess looked at her mom, bent down, and half-walked, half-crawled 4 feet through a small tunnel into another room. She gasped at the sight before her and quickly stood up and smacked her head against the ceiling. It hurt so bad that the girl stomped around for several minutes, groaning and swearing. Eventually, she sat down, rubbing her sore head and pressed her eyes closed. Her father was standing next to her, checking her bloody scalp, and announced, "She'll be fine, but it seems as though she inherited your colorful vocabulary, Orvin." Princess burst out laughing, and her head throbbed even worse. She smacked her father on the leg, said, "Stop it! You're making it hurt more!" But she was feeling a little better and returned to looking around King Osred's treasure room. There were crates of gold and silver coins, golden goblets and plates, and baskets full of necklaces, rings, and other jewelry. And there were skeins of exquisite thread and bolts of beautifully woven cloth. Princess gazed at the wealth and asked, "Why didn't you take this and start a new life for our village?" "I wish I had a good answer for that," Orvin said with a heavy sigh. "We probably should have done what you suggest, but we didn't. We felt it would raise too many questions if we tried to sell it, and none of this has much use to us in our secluded valley. Besides, all this wealth doesn't really belong to us. It either belongs to Osred or to Killwolf." Princess argued, "Well, it certainly doesn't belong to Killwolf, and Osred is surely dead by now with no heirs, so I claim that it is ours." Orvin and May looked distinctly uncomfortable all of a sudden, but Orvin simply replied, "Perhaps." May said, "I agree. Perhaps you are right, Princess," as she pulled out a small wooden box and opened it. Inside was the most beautiful necklace Princess had ever seen. It was made of a chain of perhaps 100 gold links shaped like double leaves. The chain was attached to a beautiful heart-shaped gold pendant containing a light purple gem in its center.
"It's incredible!" Princess sighed. "I've never seen anything like it. May I touch it?"
"Go ahead and try it on," laughed her mother as she lifted it out of the box. It was a short necklace which was designed with a clasp concealed as part of the pendant. May unclasped it, lifted the regal jewelry around Princess's neck, and snapped the pendant back together. The links must have been hollow because the necklace felt almost weightless to Princess. She wore it for a minute or two before taking it off to study it more carefully.
"I've never seen anything so intricate in my life. What kind of gem is this? Where did this come from?" she asked.
"The gemstone is called amethyst," explained May. "The necklace was a gift from the King of Dumnonia to King Osred as a tribute many years back. It was crafted by the Romans hundreds of years ago and brought from their homeland on one of their ships by some noble family. Osred gave this to his second wife as a wedding gift. It was her most prized possession, and she rarely took it off. You may keep it if you like." Princess felt a rush of desire for the beautiful and priceless necklace, but handed it back to May. "We'd better leave this here. Grandpa's right. It would draw attention, and then how would I ever explain where it came from? Besides, this is King Osred's property. It doesn't belong to us," she sadly replied. She took one more longing glance at her family sitting in a room full of golden treasures sparkling in the candlelight and added, "I think we should leave, but thank you for showing this to me. This is something I will never forget." The four of them left the treasure chamber, and Orvin and Hugh carefully replaced the shields which blocked the opening. They were about to continue back to the well room when Princess noticed a long, thin dagger with an elegant handle in a black leather sheath. She picked it up and asked, "Dad, would it be all right if I took this knife? Mine is old and dull." Hugh chuckled and said, "Of course, Princess. I don't think Osred's army is going to miss it." Orvin smiled and said, "That's my granddaughter. Leave the jewelry and take a weapon. I'm proud of you." Princess blushed and muttered, "It's just a knife, Grandpa." But she was proud of her decision as well.